Good evening and welcome to Representative Larry Sequist's live telephone town hall. My name is Lilia and I'll be moderating tonight's call. Thank you for taking the time to join us. We hope you'll find this call informative. In a moment, I'll turn the phone over to Representative Larry Sequist for some opening remarks, but first I want to explain the format for tonight's call. If you want to ask a question, press star 3 on your phone and you'll be connected with a staff person who will take your question and get you into the queue to speak with Representative Larry Sequist. Please note that this is a live question and answer session, and we want to get through as many of your questions as possible, so we have to limit participants to only one question each. Pressing star 3 right now is all you need to do to ask your question. Here is some information on your state representative. First elected in 2006, Larry Sequist is serving his fourth term representing the 26th Legislative District. A former U.S. Navy warship captain and Pentagon strategist, Larry followed his 32-year Navy career with a second career helping citizens and political leaders both here in America as well as in countries around the world strengthen their communities in times of crisis and conflict. Larry chairs the Higher Education Committee and is a member of the Appropriations Committee, the Appropriations Subcommittee on Education, and the Education Committee. Larry and his wife of 35 years, Carla, a playwright and writer, reside in Gig Harbor. So remember, please press star 3 on your keypad right now if you have a question for Representative Larry Sequist. And now here he is with some opening remarks. Larry?
Thank you, Lilia. Good evening. Thank you for joining us. Again, this is Larry Sequist. We do these live telephone town halls periodically to break through. To tell you the truth, the reason I find these things so interesting is that we're all surrounded by the kind of the nastiness and the dysfunction. You get the feeling, I certainly do, that no one knows what they're doing and nothing is happening. When you actually talk with ourselves on these telephone calls, I think you'll see what bright citizens we have as neighbors and what really is happening in our community. So I look forward to talking to you. We can talk about anything you like. One topic that's been on my mind is school testing. I wonder whether you've had any personal experiences with your own kids or the kids you know with this yet another round of school testing in our elementary and high schools. What do you think? Are we testing too much? Are we doing the right thing or the wrong thing? I'm increasingly concerned that we're headed in the wrong direction. And I'd sure like to hear what you've got to say. So, Lilia, let's go to our first questioner, if we may.
Okay. We don't have a question yet. People are still getting on the line. So let's talk a little bit more about the school testing.
Great. So here's what has been concerning me. As you may have read, for those of you who are following our education system, we have a federal requirement from 15 years ago called No Child Left Behind, and it's an act that requires schools to test their students with what are called high-stakes tests. And as you know, if you've been around our schools increasingly are dominated by these testing cycles. Right now, some of our schools are essentially shut down for as much as a month, 5 weeks in one elementary school that I saw, that the kids are almost all the time doing testing. There's a new kind of test called Smarter Balanced. It's a computer-based test, and even though the advantage of the computer-based test is the results come back immediately, the old test we had to wait for months. Kids had moved on to the next grade before we even knew what that test results were. So this computer is supposed to fix that. But it's turning out, as I understand it, and I'm visiting some of the schools this week, that we're burning a lot of teacher time, a lot of child attention time in those kinds of tests. I'm ready to ask for us to stop so much testing. I'm not sure we're getting anything out of it. And I would look forward to hearing your ideas. Lilia?
Okay. Yeah, Larry, thank you. Folks, please remember, press star 3 on your keypad right now. If you're just joining us, this is a live telephone town hall with your state representative, Larry Sequist. And if you have a question for him, press star 3 on your keypad right now. And we're going to go with Kim, who has a question about, hey, testing. Hello, Kim.
Hi, Kim.
I'm trying.
Okay,
there we
try
go.
again. Jim?
Hello.
Hi. And your question?
My question is, is there in the future any chance of us getting a metro bus system established out here for the KP? We're pretty isolated out here without a vehicle.
Boy, you sure are. So, as you may know, Jim, the school district under contract to some of your KP neighbors is providing minimal service with a school bus.
Yes, and it is wonderful. I will tell you, Larry, running that food bank, the Bischoff Food Bank, it was a blessing in disguise because we were unable oftentimes to satisfy the needs of the people out here. But it is, as you said, very limited. So I'm just wondering if in the future, I mean, I'd be willing to vote for an increase on my taxes to get us some service out here, and I'm sure a lot of us homeowners would.
So, Kim, before you go, tell us all a little bit about what you're doing and how that transit service would help your food distribution, please.
Well, getting the clients to and from during business hours, clearly, but also for the working poor. A lot of clients, they're hitchhiking at strange hours of the morning, noon, and night to get to Purdy, to get to Tacoma or Port Orchard or wherever their job may be.
Right.
And they're literally hitchhiking. I have a female client that works at Lowe's in Port Orchard, and for 9 months she hitchhiked at, 10 o'clock every night going to work on the graveyard shift.
Oh, God. Yeah,
and she's one of the working poor and a homeowner.
Well, Ken, bless you for everything that you and your colleagues do to help these folks. I want to come back and talk about the educational opportunities because that's another thing we need to do. So on the transit, the problem is, those of you who may not have followed this, you don't know, is when Pierce Transit got in financial trouble because sales tax receipts were down, Pierce Transit dropped the service out to KP. They did that all over the county, and they narrowed down so that there's an express bus and so on coming out of the Kissing Ride to Purdy. But that's about all we have left. So here's what I did last session after working carefully with the women in Key Peninsula in the school district who have been managing this, is we wrote a bill to allow, exactly as Kim said, the voters in the Key Peninsula to vote to provide funding that we could use to contract with school district to have more of those buses. Those buses are a very busy part of the day, but a lot of the time, those buses are sitting in the bus yard. We got that out of the House with strong support, over to the Senate, and it died in the Senate committee. So we're going to try that again next year. And in the meantime, I have been down to Kitsap Transit folks asking the board to keep supporting us. The problem is they've got a law in place now that basically puts us in the rural areas of Key Peninsula and outside the just that narrow service now. We're actually legally fenced out. So that's why I'm working on this, to allow us to create a rural transit operation so that we can do that. And, Kim, I really appreciate what you're doing, what the Mustard Seed Project is doing, what Judd Norris and Children's Home. There are so many groups, the Backpack for Kids group, there's so many groups working in Key Peninsula trying to help everybody, and there is a huge need. So, Kim, we'll keep working it, and thank you for the brilliant work that you're doing.
All right. Thank you, Larry. We had a little hiccup earlier. I'm sorry about that. So, folks, if you're just joining us, this is a telephone town hall with your representative, Larry Sequist. And if you have a question or a comment for him, please press *3 on your keypad right now. That's all you need to do. We're going to go with Jane, who has a comment or a question about No Child Left Behind. Jane?
Hi. Thank you. Hi. My husband was a middle school principal for years in Tacoma. His two brothers also were teachers. My daughter's a middle school principal and another daughter teacher. And this No Child Left Behind, it doesn't give a very accurate report to parents because when they test these kids, They test the special ed kids, the BD kids, every group. And they put the scores all together. And also they don't allow for the fact that many of these children are in and out of schools. They move often, and sometimes they come back in the course of the year, sometimes not. Well, when all this is put together and the school doesn't score very high, then the parents get a letter saying, this school is not doing its job and you can transfer your children. That's really unfair because it gives the parents the impression that the teachers aren't working hard enough. And in reality, with all these other factors factored in, they probably are doing a real good job for the most part, and still the parents think that the school isn't doing its job. That needs to be fixed. First of all, these kids can't go to other schools that supposedly are doing better, where the kids are more stable, and they can't get in. All these kids can't go to these schools that score higher. So it's really frustrating as a parent and as an educator to see this happening.
Jean, so, you are so right. I'm hoping that everyone really listened to that carefully. That is as good a diagnosis of what's going wrong with this No Child Left Behind testing as I've heard. But the special education problem, the kids who move, we have high mobility, particularly in society. As Kim was saying, lots of folks who don't have more than a couple of nickels, they don't get to stay in one place all those times. So kids and poor families get bumped around. Now, it's going to be this letter. Jean mentioned the letter that the school is failing. You're going to see those. I don't know about Peninsula School District or our school districts here, but you may well see those letters going out in August all over the state.
Mm-hmm.
Because we in the legislature, including me, refused to take another step down the road with No Child Left Behind. We had already passed legislation to improve the grading of teachers. Our teachers used to be either pass-fail, are you a good teacher or not? And after several years of work on this, our teachers, administrators, everybody agreed we would create a new evaluation system called TPEP, the Teacher Principal Evaluation Program. And our teachers, in fact, the Peninsula School District teachers helped invent it. Everybody was very happy with that. And what it said in that law was the local district may use this kid's scores as part of the evaluation of the teachers. The feds came back to us and said, it has to say shall. And that took us exactly into the testing score problems that Jean just talked about. It doesn't make any sense. Any one teacher at any one point is teaching kids who are the aggregate of all of the school's work and the prior year's work. I discovered some research out of by a woman researcher in Stanford, University of California, that showed kids in 1 year of math class were actually doing better if the prior year's English teacher was really effective. A lot of math classes these days have these narrative story problems. It was clear if the kids knew their English better, they did better in math the next year. So who's supposed to get the score for that? And because of that, we said no. Now, we're in the middle of a battle here. This is a struggle for independence. For us to say, you know, feds, keep your hands off. The education is a local matter. We've got very good teachers. We've got very carefully managed systems. We can handle that. We don't need these onerous rules. So, Jean, thank you very much for your points. I strongly agree with you. And I would advise everyone, you're going to hear more about this from me and from everybody else through the summer, particularly in August and fall, as we get into the next school year. I, for one, am taking a vote for freedom here that it's time for us to manage our schools again and get the feds off our back with this terrible testing system. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Larry. Folks, please remember to press *3 on your keypad right now if you have a question or a comment for your State Representative Larry Sequist. And so Here's the thing. We're about one-third of the way into this call. There are a lot of you on the line, so we appreciate that. And get your questions in. Press star 3, okay? We're going to go now with Lori, who has a question about GMO food labeling.
Hi, Lori.
Hi, Larry. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you. Thanks for the call.
Sure. I talked to you at the Y, and
yeah.
I was hoping to get in touch with you and find out who to talk to. But I never heard back, and maybe I just missed your message.
Yeah, about GMO labeling.
Yeah, and the thing is, there's new information about glyphosate and how bad it is for us, and that's the active ingredient in Roundup, and most people don't know about that. There's a recent peer-reviewed paper by Dr. Stephanie Seneff and Anthony Samsell. People can look it up and find out more, but it's serious what it's doing to our kids. Because they're spraying this stuff all over the place. We need to get them to stop. I just talked to the Parks and Rec in Kitsap County, and that's one of the things that they use to spray.
Okay.
That's the only thing they use to spray.
So, if you would stay on the line after and let one of the screeners get your phone, your email, I will get back to you ASAP. You and I have a further talk. And let me explain to other folks, GMO, genetically modified organisms. There is a group, Lori is clearly one of the leaders about this, that have for several years been saying we ought to label any foods that you would see in a grocery store. They've got all these labels on them about how many calories and how much salt in it and so on. It ought also to say that the food is based or is been manufactured with the genetically modified ingredients. I was a little skeptical, as Lori or some of her colleagues may know. At first, I thought, I'm not sure we really need to go that far. But the deeper I looked into this, the more I'm absolutely convinced it's the right thing to do. And there's two kinds of problems. One is that the reason why the original genetic modifications were made was to be able to use very high intensity pesticides on wheat and some other grains in order to get your grain and kill the weeds in a very effective fashion. And Monsanto is the company that does the most of this work. As you may know, if you're a farmer, you know that you don't actually get to replant your own wheat. If you buy that wheat seed, you get to use it for 1 year. Then you've got to go buy wheat from them again the next year. So one problem is that those pesticides may in fact be leaking over into the genes of the wheat, and that we're actually importing into our food cycle some of those things that the wheat was designed in the laboratory not to do. The second thing that really is the conclusive argument for me is that we've only begun creating genetically modified and factory-made foods. So personally, I think it's time for us to put these labels on there. The food industry has been really resisting this all over the country. But in Europe, for example, this is already a matter of course. The Europeans have been labeling their food this way for years. So I'm strongly in favor of getting on with GMO. We've had bills to do that. We didn't quite get that one through this time, but I'm ready to try again. So, Lori, thanks very much. Look forward to talking to you personally again and getting you connected with some more staff people. Thank you.
Thank you. And, Lori, so please press star 3 on your keypad again so that we can get all your info. And everyone else, please press star 3 if you have a question or a comment for your state representative, Larry Sequist. We're about halfway through this call, and so we're going to go now with Steve, who has a question about school levies.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, Larry. Yeah, the reason I called you is I was just curious. We've got a kind of a complicated levy coming up that both lists levy and bond. Wouldn't it have been a lot more clear to the voter if we'd just gone with a levy and with that direction? Because I think people are thinking that they're going to be paying twice as much money. I think there's a lot of confusion out there.
Right. Yes, Steve, again, this is a local, and for those of you who may not be in the Peninsula School District, the Peninsula School District has a double levy measure on the ballot for August. The primary will be in August, so we'll get those ballots mailed out about the third week in July, and one of the measures on there, or two of them, will be this local levy. The Peninsula School District Board, as I understand it, made the decision in response to the concerns of voters from the last time they put this forward to do a two-step. The basic problem, as I think Steve and other people have been involved in this know, we need to build two new schools. Artindale needs to be rebuilt, and we need up in the Purdy Elementary area, up by Target, the YMCA area, we need a whole new elementary school up there. We're just packed to the rafters with kids. So we needed to build two new schools with a bond. And the state law says that if you're going to do a levy for operating expenses, you only need a 50% vote. But if you're going to build something, you need a 60% vote with that bond. And what the school board did is going to do one of each. And as I understand it, their slogan is, vote yes twice. And if you vote yes twice, the second part mostly cancels itself out if the first part is yes also, and you end up with a package that is the two new schools plus some of the other things, the computer technology and some other things that needed to be done around the district, including some work out in Key Peninsula. So as Steve points out, it's a complicated two-part vote. I thought their slogan made a lot of sense, vote yes twice. That's my own view, but it was a complicated choice. The basic need is an important one. And you need to remember the reason why the school district is running this bond levy is because the state hasn't met its funding duties. It is in the Constitution that we should provide ample funding for every child's education, every child resident in the state, unquote. And the state has not been sending enough money to these schools. So we end up with the local folks running levies in order to build schools. That's the top of my work list, is to keep working on getting what's called the McCleary, the court case that said we've got to spend more. That's where I am. But back to Steve's point, yes, it's a complicated vote. I do think I understand why the school board said they should go that way. My own intention is to vote yes twice, and I would ask everybody, keep taking a look at both those parts because they're addressing important needs of our school. Thanks, Steve.
All right. Thank you. And so let's see. We're about halfway to this call, and we're having a lot of fun. There's a lot of you on the call, and we're grateful for that. If you have a question or a comment for your state representative, Larry Sequist, please press *3 on your keypad right now. And we're going to now go with Michelle, who has a question about class sizes, but this time in higher ed. Michelle?
Thank you. Hello, Mr. Sequest.
Hi, Michelle.
We have a lot of parents here in the South Kitsap High School District that are concerned about the class sizes. Now,
yes,
in my understanding, that they don't want more than 30 kids in a class. Well, I think by the time you get to be a senior in high school, maybe it's time to realize that your child, if they want to go on to college, is going to be sitting in an auditorium with maybe 500 other kids. So by the time you're a senior, don't you think that they've probably got a pretty good grasp or they should have a pretty good grasp on how to learn,
sure,
and if they're going to go on to college, I mean, 30 kids is nothing in a class compared to what they're going to get next year.
Yeah.
What's your opinion on that?
So, yeah, Michelle is raising a very interesting and important question. It's one that has got a couple of $1 billion of investment associated with it. What we've done, we know, for example, if you walk into a kindergarten class and talk to a kindergarten teacher with five-year-olds, she, according to the research and according to the kind of opinion of kindergarten teachers, she can handle 17 kids and do it extremely well. But over the school district, South Kitsap, Bremerton, Peninsula school districts, those class sizes for kindergarten, first, second, third grade, where the kids are little and they need a lot of personal attention, that class should be down around 17. We're running in our school districts and around the state 23, 22, 25, something like that. And as one of the kindergarten teachers told me, says, you know, if you think you have a hard time taking care of 2 5-year-olds, you come with me and spend several hours a day taking care of 25. So we do know that at that level, we need to bring that number down. In middle school, that number went up into the, from 17, I think, up to 20. Middle school kids, again, as Michelle suggests, you're a little older, you can have more kids in the classroom. And if I remember the number, Michelle, for high school, it's around 26 or 27 would be the standard. Now, that would mean some classes were smaller and some classes were bigger, but as Michelle points out, it recognizes that you could have more. Looking at an entire school district, like South Kitsap, where Michelle was making her example, we would still need to add, to get those class size, those teacher ratios right, we would need to add more than 100 teachers, and in order to have 100 teachers, we would need to add a lot more classrooms. We don't even have the physical classrooms, again, because of the funding problem that Steve on the previous call pointed to. Now, we need to raise those numbers by putting more money into the school district's hands. As Michelle says, as they get older, the classes can be a little bit larger. That's the number we're using right now is 26, 27. But that's an average, and many high schools will have much larger classes for some of the basic classes. Beyond class size and teacher ratios, one other thing I should mention is the paraeducators. One of our earlier callers, Jean, I think it was, is that's talking about special education. Particularly in the high needs kids, the special education classes, that teacher needs a paraeducator, an assistant, who is not as highly trained, but those assistant teachers are extremely valuable for helping make sure that the kids who need a little extra help are getting that help. Folks, we do not pay those paraeducators enough. I know a woman in Port Orchard loves being a paraeducator. She's been doing it for 18 or 19 years. She's formally paid for about 30, 33 hours a week, something like that. She works 45 or 50 hours a week, and her total salary gross is only about $17,000, if I remember her numbers. And last year she got a pay raise, 6 cents. It's just we've got to not only make sure we've got enough teachers, we've got to have enough of those paraeducators in those classes so the kids can need the special help. So, Michelle, thank you very much for the call. You put your finger on an important point, and that the kids need to be able to grow and handle larger and larger classes as they get older. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Folks, please press star 3 on your keypad if you have a question or a comment for your state representative, Larry Sequist. And talking about paraeducators, we're going to get Deborah on the line, who is a paraeducator.
Hi, Deborah.
Hi.
Did I get the numbers right?
Actually, you did. Good evening, Representative Larry Sequist. I'm so grateful that you're giving us this opportunity for a voice. I am a paraeducator, and I do happen to work for the Peninsula School District in a special needs room. My point is that most of us earn just above minimum wage. Most of us, not just a minority, need to hold two jobs because it's not a living wage. And most of us, even after 10 years of service, are earning less today in our paychecks than we did 10 years ago, just because insurances have gone up and wages sure. haven't. We earn about a fifth of what the teachers do, and we are 40% of the staff is support staff. Someone ran the numbers, and 60% are teachers. That's what's right. in the schools.
Right. So,
and we've had no cost of living as the teachers for six
right.
years now. And nothing looks like it's, I mean, it's just not, we're not earning enough to pay our bills or eat, and yet working two jobs is just, it's overwhelming.
And, you know, so there's something that I talk to teachers regularly all over this, in fact, all over the state. Teachers and the paraeducators, the staff, they're exhausted, folks. These people the legislature has been piling on more and more requirements, not providing money. We've got this court case where Cleary is saying we should be providing more resources to these schools. I mean, it's not right. It is not right that a paraeducator who loves her work is doing something extremely valuable. And I'm telling you, folks, these paraeducators who take care of special needs kids, who are taking care of their personal sanitation and all of those kinds of needs, they're saints. And they need, they're professionals, they're valuable, we need to make sure they're paid right, and we need to make sure that all of our educators are finally put back on the path to increased income. Every teacher I know is making less than they were making 6 or 10 years ago. They haven't had pay raises, their costs have gone up, insurance has gone up, and they're exhausted. I'm committed to keep working on this McCleary. You're going to find that in the next legislature, we need to come up with $4.5 billion just in the next budget, just for K-12, as the higher ed guy. I can fight for a site. Similar problems in our community colleges and universities. We simply have to invest more in education. And if there was some way we could do it, Deborah, on this phone, we ought to all push the like button for paraeducators. In fact, I go beyond like. I love you guys. You're just wonderful, and we're paying you peanuts, and it's wrong. Thanks for the call, and thanks for everything you do.
Thank you. We have about 25 minutes left of this call. We appreciate that you're joining us here. If you have a question or a comment for your State Representative Larry Sequist, please press *3 on your keypad right now. We're going to go with David, who has a question or a comment about making school more interesting and motivating kids. David?
Oh,
great.
Yeah. Hi, Larry. this is a great thing you're doing for the community. I'm understanding that money is really very important here. It's the primary problem. But I also called in just because I wanted to ask, isn't there a way to stop all this emphasis on testing? I never liked it as a student. What I liked mm-hmm. was the teacher that got in there and made that subject so interesting to me that
yep.
as challenging me to get into it further, whatever the subject matter might be.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it can be done, and maybe that's where our teachers need help, to how to present the subject matter, whatever subject it might be, in a way that excites and motivates our students
mm-hmm.
instead of just trying to test them all the time.
Right.
Is there any way of doing that?
Yes. If we keep working together, we can do that. And one thing is to remove this nationally required. The feds insisting we do this high-stakes testing over and over, and us insisting on ourselves. We do this to ourselves, too.
Yeah.
We're in a place. There was an article in the paper just a couple of days ago, across the weekend. As you know, Big Brother, we all know that National Security Agency or Google or Amazon is watching all of our keystrokes on our computers, I guess. There are Lexicon Academy. When the kids are online with many of these courses, the machinery, the software of the computer, as it is, the student is interacting with the computer, is also measuring where the student knew what. I've talked to many teachers in classrooms who are watching what their students are learning, how they're responding. We have, for example, something called the Western Governors University. It's a virtual university here in Washington State where you can get a graduate degree or an undergraduate degree. There are no buildings. The entire thing is virtual. But those teachers are watching all the time how their students are performing. So this comes back to David and making it interesting in testing. If we could remove the testing and simply let the learning process be visible, I think we would know everything that the teacher needed to know about how the student was doing. Now, here is a hopeful thing that doesn't actually cost less money. Something that's going on, David, around our districts and I think all over the state is an increase into classes learning that is project-based or real-life-based. So, for example, even in a K-6 elementary school up in Bremerton, West Sound STEM Academy, they've got naval shipyard engineers. I know I've met one of the women who's a naval shipyard marine architect engineer. Every week, she spends about 3 hours in one of those classrooms working with the kids about what the real-world problems are. And even the little kids are thinking about how you measure things or do whatever it is that particular engineering problem is. Now, in high schools, we used to call that SHOP or vocational education. Now it's called career and technical education. And it's a way in which the students in middle school, high school, are studying things that have real-world application. Kids like that. And that means that we need to put experts in the classroom alongside the teacher to give, there's what I do in the real world when I'm in a laboratory or when I'm building a house, or fixing a car engine, whatever I'm doing, here are the kinds of problems I'm solving. The kids can see how to do that. Kids all over the state, you'll see this happening a lot. And as David Paul started out by saying, is there a way to make it more interesting? Because we've got this high dropout rate. Folks, more than almost a quarter, maybe in some schools, more than a quarter of our kids don't even graduate from high school. That's a disaster. That's the end of their life for them. They're almost none of those kids will ever amount to anything because they don't have even the basic tickets to go to work in this high school's life. If we can make it more interesting, connect school to what they might do in life, all of the research and all of the experience says that's the way we've got to go. It's to shift to practical problems for these kids and to get away from the impractical testing. So, David, thank you very much. You know, another thought that comes to mind, our kids grow up these days without knowing much about what adults do. I was born and grew up on a farm, so I knew what everybody did because I did it myself. And if I had to measure something in school, like how big is that acre, well, I knew how an acre was because I had just been out walking that acre. But the kids these days, you know, they live in this kind of sterile, just youth climate with no real connection with adults and what they do. So we need ways to bring a lot more adults into the classroom so that they can show the kids what's interesting about life and interesting about their studies. So, David, I think we all need to keep working on that, keep supporting those teachers, offering to help them. Lelia?
Yeah, thank you. And so we're going to switch gears here very soon. We're going to talk about the Narrows Bridge in a minute. But before we do that, folks, please press star 3 on your keypad if you have a question or a comment for your State Representative Larry Sequist. And Larry, before we go with the next question, you want to talk a little bit about Khan Academy in case people don't know about it?
Sure. Khan Academy, you can go on Khan Academy and Google that. There's a young fellow who had a niece who was having a hard time studying algebra. So he did, you know, the way the kids use YouTube. He just brought it, taped himself, videoed himself with his computer camera, explaining to her how to do that algebra problem. Well, that turned in. He was very good at that. Salman Khan. And he is now got this entire nonprofit corporation. We have, for example, in Bremerton, there is the Washington Youth Academy. This is a spectacular place. It's up at the Armory in West Bremerton, up above Auto Row there, and above the sewage treatment plant, up on a hill. There are 150 high school dropouts, 50 females, 100 males. They come there for 22 weeks, two classes a year. And it's a military looking. They wear uniforms. They've got, they're totally squared away, sleep in barracks rooms, so on. And they, with Bremerton High School teachers, use the Khan Academy classes to catch back up. And they're doing amazing things. We, out of the 150 kids, we will get 145 of them on their feet, back, ready to finish high school, on with life, headed for college. And what they're using is this Khan Academy to help them catch up on their math and English and everything else. I actually go online and take Khan Academy courses. I was looking through the French Revolution. And then the other day there was something about some chemistry thing I didn't understand. Sure enough, Khan Academy's got a little course on that. And it's only 5 or 6 minutes long. It's really cool. So
that's great, Larry. Thank you.
Let's go on to Narrows Bridge, Lelia.
Yeah, so we're going to go with, before we do that, folks, let me just remind you, if you have a question or a comment for Larry Sequist, please press star 3 on your keypad right now. We're going with Stephanie, who has a question about Narrows tolling. Stephanie?
Hi, Stephanie.
I'm here. So as far as new, let's see, 2017, the bridge toll is going to go up to 625. Is that correct?
So, Stephanie, here's what I know for a fact. That the fact is that on the 1st of July this year, it goes from for the cash people, it goes up to another quarter. We all put group pay another quarter. 550 cash and 450 for those of us who use the good to go sticker. It's someplace up in that zone of six, the original projection was about $6. I frankly don't trust that. Bridge use is a little bit below where it was originally projected. That's been one of the problems. Personally, I was just talking with Washtenaw this afternoon, one of the Washtenaw executives was up here working on some road problems with us. And I still think we're seeing traffic growth. So here's my approach to this. I don't know about Stephanie, but I tell you, I'm ready. 425 right now is already too high.
It's very high. And I had a discussion with my dad the other day, and I said, how are they charging for the 520? They're already charging them for a bridge that's already been built.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Exactly right. So here we are. We're paying 100% of our bridge, and we're paying for the 520 bridge, which is a mess,
The tunnel. Yeah, I think that's why our toll keeps going higher is because we're paying for stuff up in King County, and we're in Pierce County, and this is the way it's going.
Yeah. Well, so Stephanie, the way we pay for those five Torrey King County projects is through gas tax, not through tolls. All of our tolls is only going to operating the bridge and paying the debt. But unlike 520, where we are helping with our gas tax pay their bridge construction, we are not only paying gas tax, we're also paying for a little bridge. So here's what I'm proposing. So roll back and cap. I would like to see us roll back the toll to $4, period, and that would generate about $50 million a year, and that everything above that, just like a 520 bridge, would be paid by gas tax with everybody. We're helping build their bridge. They need to help us build our bridge. So my battle cry is roll back and cap at $4. We're all going to need to work together next year to try to make sure that legislature does that, especially if they come out with one of these, with the transportation package. So that's my proposal. In the meantime, Stephanie, if you're interested in how the tolls are set, we have a Citizens Advisory Committee, CAC. It has an open seat on it. And if you were interested in being one of those citizens on that panel, you would be involved in the annual process of reviewing how high should the toll go and when would we change it. And Lily, if I've got another minute, I'd like to make sure that people understand something else, because we all pay attention to bridge tolls.
Sure, go ahead.
Another question we've got, folks, is when do we shut down the toll booths, the cash booths? Because you could easily, technically, we don't need those booths. So if you go through and you don't have a good-to-go sticker, the computer will still read your license plate and mail your bill, and you'll pay $6 instead of $5.25 if you pay. Here's the problem. The contractor, the problem starts with the fact that we actually make more money for ourselves to pay bonds off the cash transactions than we do for good to go. It's a dollar higher, and it does cost more to pay that toll booth person, but it doesn't cost a whole dollar. So if we took away the cash booth, we might have to increase the tolls, and none of us are ready to do that. Second problem is the contractor who runs the computer system in the back office is in financial trouble. It turns out that that contractor, ETC Seaford Texas, underbid the contract and WashDOT bought into that contract. So it for the moment, it's a good deal for us. It's the contractor's problem. That contractor is apparently losing about $2 million a year, and at some point, the contractor is going to go broke or we're in trouble. And that's another reason. Hang on here. We gave WashDOT $300,000 in the transportation budget to go figure out how they can get out of this mess and get us on the path to controlling toll costs and to gradually moving away from those cash booths. But right now, we're hanging on. 1st of July, unfortunately, it's going to bump up another quarter. So,
all right,
Stephanie, thanks. Let's keep working on that. Roll back and cap is my slogan.
Okay, we have 10 minutes left of this call. If you have not gotten your question in, it's still time. Please press *3 on your keypad right now. And let's stay on the transportation issue and talk with Sandra about transportation cost savings.
Hi, Sandra.
Good evening, Larry. This is Sandra. And, boy, that was a lot of great information covered regarding the tolls on the Narrows Bridge. And I know that I was out this weekend talking with some people in neighborhoods on a campaign issue. And I can't tell you how many raised that particular issue about the bridge and how angry they are about that.
Right.
So, I know that, I don't know how it would happen that we would get that cap and, rollback and cap, item in, but that would make a big difference to people who are trying to work and have their family. I heard things from both aspects of labor and, family that cannot go back and forth because it's just too costly.
Oh, so
bravo with that one. And here's
students,
my question.
Yeah, go ahead, Sandra, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, here is my question. Wasn't there some cost savings somewhere along the way? Somebody found some savings where the taxpayers didn't have to have an increase, and we were able to freeze for a while anyhow. I mean, I can't remember who that was, but we were able to freeze the cost of increase on the Narrows Bridge and some other ferry costs or something like that. Do you remember anyone that had an impact on that?
When he was a state senator, Derek Kilmer and I, Pat Lance, Jan Angel helped when she was in the House. We were all trying to squeeze the cost of the bridge. When they opened, back when the bridge opened, they were going to have 23 state staff members attached to the bridge. The bridge was going to have its own spokesperson. We raised hell about that. And so there is a very minuscule staff. We've really tried to trim back to make sure that the bridge operating costs were the absolute minimum. But I think we're about that. Now, here's the place that I'm really nervous about whether or not we understand efficiency on the bridge. You remember, if you used to go through and you didn't have a good-to-go sticker and you just drove through, you would get a ticket, like a speeding ticket. And that ticket would go to the district court over in Tacoma.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, even if it's half a percent, it was actually 2% of the drivers, you know, with 40,000 drivers, 2%. So there were, you know, several dozen tickets a day being generated, and then those folks would have to go over and see the judge. In order to soften that system, so what happened is at WSDOT's request, we moved from the ticket the system to a civil infraction. It wasn't a traffic ticket, so it didn't go on your record. And instead of the judges at the district court, we hired new administrative law judges in Olympia to go through those infractions. Here's the problem. One, many people, if you go through and you don't have a ticket and you get the thing in the mail, you've got 80 days, you get a letter a couple of times. Finally, if you don't respond, you're going to get this judicial notice, and then you're supposed to be in trouble. But, again, we don't know how many of those people are actually paying up, how much money should be coming back to the bridge, or how much the judicial law judges are costing us. So I'm really concerned that we've still got this leak over on the side of the budget. It may not be huge, but 2 or 3%, it might be able to hold off the next quarter, you know, for a few months or half a year, something like that. And so I and Jan Angel, the others, we're all working on it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Sandra. We have about 5 minutes.
You know, other things that are going on in TCC, Tacoma Community College has a Gig Harbor campus. They've adjusted their course offerings. So they have what you can call this get a degree toll-free. They've adjusted the offerings over in Gig Harbor so that you could get a two-year degree at TCC without paying tolls. Because if you're a student or you're working two jobs and trying to go to community college to get a degree, you just can't afford to get over there. Fortunately, we have a hospital on this side. But we don't have the transit to get across the bridge, so we really are trapped behind those. We've got to act, and that's why I keep saying roll back and cap. We have got to see the whole state start sharing in the cost of our bridge just like we share in the cost of building theirs. Lelia?
Mm-hmm. So we have around 4 minutes left, maybe a little bit less than that. So I think that's all the time we have for questions tonight. If you did not get a chance to ask your question, please do stay on the line because you'll be able to leave a message for your State Representative Larry Sequist at the conclusion of this call. Thank you for joining us tonight. And now let's hear some closing remarks from you, Larry.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry we couldn't get one more question in. trying to think of what else we should talk about. There may be people on here. We've been talking about bridges and transit. For those of you who are riding ferries, I'm really concerned. We've got, in fact, I want to go back and make one more point for this Sanders thing about how we can actually do something about the bridge. We also need to fix up our ferry system. Something that is very inefficient, in my view, is the headquarters of the ferry system in Seattle. We've got very fine sailors, men and women who are the masters, the mates on deck that handle the cars, the engineers below deck. Those ferries are run by very good seagoing people. But our headquarters in Seattle is just oversized. It's bulked up. It's just we need to keep seeing them trimmed down. And that's something that really needs to be cut. Now, if we get one of the biggest decisions facing all of us in this state is whether or not we increase gas tax in order to increase maintenance. If we do that, I voted for that. I'm on the record voting for that gas tax increase. It didn't pass. Went on the Senate and died, and we're still kind of waiting for the next move. I voted for that because that would have fully funded our ferry operating system, and it would have made sure that the Tacoma port was functional with good highway service to move freight. But next time, I personally will not vote for that gas tax unless we also have this rollback and cap for our bridge. If we're going to raise that gas tax, folks, my position is that we don't raise the gas tax until the increased tax also helps us survive on this bridge. We've got to go back to $4 and stay there. And the other thing, that you know, the Declaration of Independence on the bridge, as I said earlier in our earlier conversations, we need to declare independence from this federally imposed, onerous, all-day, all-week-long testing, and give our teachers and our students the chance to go do some real learning without all this extra testing. Thank you all for joining us this evening. We really appreciate it. I hope you have enjoyed these conversations as much as I do. You can see what interesting, thoughtful neighbors we all have. I really appreciate that. Thank you very much. Thank you for the privilege of serving you. And Lelia, thanks very much for this evening's phone call.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Good night.